Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we have finally graduated from the Articles of Confederation, and we've got Paul back. Welcome back, Paul. And so, while we're getting ready to dive into this, setting the stage, the states have kind of gone through, I'll just say, a lot of little quakes and shakeups, the Shea Rebellion. I mean, there's a lot of things that we could include that helps, I think, provide some clarity as to how things were not so good in Kansas, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
And so what we are doing here is we're finally getting in this next document we're going to read. This is a convention of commissioners in Annapolis in 1786. And this is basically, you know, how they've got together and what they ended up doing, so that they set the stage for what is going to happen in the coming year. And I believe, I don't know if I can find it, but I do know that actually, based on the Federalist Papers, this Annapolis meeting in September basically creates this report that then goes to Congress. And I presume that it sat waiting for Congress to actually respond, which they ended up responding in February of 1787, calling for the states to convene a convention to fix the federal Constitution. And so then we'll read that document, and then that will kind of set the stage for the Constitutional Convention. And but before we actually get into, you know, anything else, the final document that we're actually going to cover is a combination of, I think, 13 documents. And these are the enabling acts to basically appoint and empower delegates to represent their state in this upcoming Constitutional Convention.
And so, Jr.?
Yeah, go ahead.
So what you're saying is this is, when you say 13, that suggests that each state had its own instructions. Is that right?
That is correct. As a matter of fact, so we'll go through Rhode Island at a real high level, because Rhode Island didn't show up. And as a matter of fact,
right,
when you look at the Rhode Island acts that they were, you know, passing, it was constantly changing. And okay, as a matter of fact, I think that was one of the reasons why they didn't show up. Because, you know, they this kind of goes down the path of, if we had Republic Review, in other words, if we had the majority of the states pulling together to say, you know what, we're going to deal with this out of control federal government, we're going to get them back into the framework of the Constitution, and they're going to start complying to our compact.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how many of these hard left progressive states will show up?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Because you have to view, look at California and how they've completely abandoned the Constitution. And so at least their government and their government leaders and their democracy, you know, has completely abandoned the Constitution. So would they really show up? Now, anybody that understands, you know, that if you're not in that meeting, if you're not at that altar, you know, or that table, you know, of, you know, arbitrating and, you know, having some voice, then, you know, it's almost like you can't complain, right? I mean, if you're not there to kind of stick up for what you believe in, then there's no point in complaining.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with that, I see this as the as the inevitable, that what California would do. And I had this conversation with Keith, a friend of ours, Keith Broders, because Keith basically said then based on the concept of nullification and secession, that California would be in its rights to secede. And right. At least that was Keith's premise. And I said, actually, no, because the only way you can secede from the Union is if the Union is applying tyranny or unconstitutionality. In other words, maybe you want the unconstitutionality, but if we, you know, if the federal government actually gets in line and does what they're supposed to be doing, and you want to leave the Union because of that, that doesn't fly. The whole point is that you have a right to nullify and secede when the compact is being violated. But when the compact is being complied to, what's your recourse?
Right.
And so, anyway, hopefully that makes sense that, you know, there's very little you can do if you want to, because what could end up happening, I explained this to Keith as well, what could end up happening is the federal government could actually send in marshals and or, I will just say, an enforcement entity, whether that be the militia or what have you, to go into California and arrest all of those in California government for treason, for trying to secede from a union that is finally getting aligned with the supreme law of the land. And you want to rebel against that? You're rebelling against the Constitution, literally. That right there is why Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was written.
Right. Interesting thing, GR. You know, we did maybe a year and a half ago, remember, I went through all of the states with Democratic governors and found out that most of the counties were Republican,
yeah,
right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
I just looked up California, and it's one of those.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, in the 2016 presidential election, votes per county, there's only 3,000 votes difference between blue counties and red counties.
Right.
Okay. And so what happens, I think this goes to your premise that counties are important because these people can really, if counties stand up, we can probably go back. We can reclaim the republic. Right?
Right. Yep.
Okay. Didn't mean to interrupt you, but I thought that was important to notice.
No, that's a good point. And so we've got this convention that's forming, and this is September 1786, a year before the convention. This is literally a year before the convention lets out. And again, it's September 11th.
Wow.
Another significant day in our history, right? And so what we have here is we've got two delegates from New York, Alexander Hamilton and Egbert Benson, and then from New Jersey, an Abraham Clark, a William Houston, and a James Sherman. And then we've got a Tench Cox from Pennsylvania and then Delaware. So in other words, there was only five states here. Delaware was George Reed, John Dickinson, Richard Bissett, and then from Virginia, Edmund Randolph, who happened to be governor, James Madison, St. George Tucker, and Mr. Dickinson, who was unanimously elected as the chairman. And then we'll get into the proceedings. So at this point, you can go ahead and kind of talk about, or actually just go ahead and read how this kind of transpired, because all of this is a narrative. And I think it really helps set the stage of what these men, because again, I have to highlight, this is five states out of 13.
Right.
Now, if you look at the states that are here, the two prominent commerce states, New York and Virginia, were there. Mm-hmm. It would have been helpful to have Massachusetts there. But what was happening in Massachusetts? They were just going through a Shay Rebellion. Right. And so, but Pennsylvania being another large state. Mm-hmm. So we had three good-sized states and then the two smaller states, New Jersey and Delaware. So was this an adequate sampling? I'm posing this as the question because I believe that there was enough urgency felt throughout the Union that when Continental Congress sent what they're going to send in January following this, that everybody else kind of agreed, but Madison saw it a little differently. He thought that the only way that this Constitutional Convention could actually happen is to ensure the dignity of the convention, and that would be by making sure that George Washington attended.
Mm-hmm.
Because if George Washington attended, then that would basically be a message to everybody that that's how important this convention is.
Right.
And so that's a whole nother story. It's a really good book of Madison's pursuit in the Constitutional Convention. I think Gutzman writes a little book on or a good part of a book of his on the Constitutional Convention of what Madison really went through to get Washington there. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, a simple letter. Hey, could you please attend? It took some time and convincing and getting other people to convince Washington. But anyway, go ahead. It starts off with the commissioners produce their credentials from their respective states. So in other words, you just couldn't walk in. You actually had to have credentials.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So here we go. So the commissioners produce their credentials from their respective states, which were read. After a full communication of sentiments and deliberate consideration of what would be proper to be done by the commissioners now assembled, it was unanimously agreed that a committee be appointed to prepare a draft of a report to be made to the states having commissioners attending at this meeting, adjourned to Wednesday morning. So the first thing they did is they agreed to a committee to prepare a draft of a report, which wasn't going to come till the end, right?
That is correct. Yep.
Okay. So first order of business, there's going to be a report and there's going to be a committee to do this report to the states having members in attendance. Okay.
Yep.
So then they adjourned to Wednesday morning. Now it's Wednesday, September 13th, 1786. Met agreeable to adjournment. The committee appointed for that purpose reported the draft of the report, which being read, the meeting proceeded to the consideration thereof, and after some time spent therein, adjourned till tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know how long they met on Wednesday, September 13th. It looks like they, you know what I mean? It looks like they came for a specific purpose, and then they left. It could have been an hour. It could have been 2 hours. We don't have any record of that.
You got to remember that when you're getting a bunch of people together, the first thing they have to do, and this kind of is evident in some of the ratification debates, that they have to set decorum. They have to choose who's going to be the chair. They have to, how are we going to function and work, you know, and, you know, today it's kind of Robert's Rules of Order, right? And back in those days, they didn't have that. They had probably, you know, their own parliamentary proceedings that they all had to kind of agree upon. And there were a couple of states, if I remember correctly, that they actually went through certain things that they would allow, they wouldn't allow these types of comments or what have you. And, you know, so they laid out the, you know, rules of engagement for this meeting. And then they basically, you know, convened and then they figured out, okay, so, you know, some of these people may have came in with an agenda to say, oh, I want to introduce this stuff. And then come to find out the decorum was set that you couldn't just introduce that agenda. So you had to go back and figure out, how am I going to get this in a different way? Or what have you.
Yeah.
So you have to strategize. And so the next day they met. And so so we went from the 13th. Now we're meeting on the 14th.
Let me make another observation, if you don't mind.
Uh-huh.
These days we're familiar with Robert's Rules of Order. It hasn't been forever. Like you said, they didn't have it back then. But let me tell you what they did have. I discovered this quite by accident a few months ago. They had Jefferson's Rules of Order. And when Jefferson was the vice president, he wrote the rules for the Senate conducting itself, which I believe are still in use today.
Yes. Yeah, he actually wrote down the proceedings, how they would function, all that. Yep, he sure did.
Sure. Anyway, so Thursday, September 14th, 1786, met agreeable to adjournment. The meeting resumed the consideration of the draft of the report, and after some time spent therein and amendments made, the same was unanimously agreed to, and this is as follows, to wit. To the Honorable, the legislatures of Virginia, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York, the commissioners from the said states respectively assembled at Annapolis, humbly beg leave to report that pursuant to their several appointments, they met at Annapolis in the state of Maryland on the 11th day of September instant, and have proceeded, and having proceeded to a communication of their powers, they found that the states of New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia had in substance and nearly in the same terms authorized their respective commissioners, quote, to meet such commissioners as were or might be appointed by the other states in the Union at such time and place as should be agreed upon by the said commissioners, to take into consideration the trade and commerce of the United States, to consider how far an uniform system in their commercial intercourse and regulations might be necessary to their common interest and permanent harmony, and to report to the several states such an act relative to this great object as when unanimously ratified by them would enable the United States and Congress assembled effectually to provide for the same, end quote. So help me understand here.
So in other words, they're basically stating that they're authorized to meet as the commissioners of these states to provide both the states and Congress, you know, this basic report of what their recommendations are.
Okay. So next paragraph.
Uh-huh.
That the state of Delaware had given similar power to their commissioners, with this difference only, that the act to be framed in virtue of those powers is required to be reported, quote, to the United States in Congress assembled, to be agreed to by them and confirmed by the legislatures of every state, end quote. That the state of New Jersey had enlarged the object of their appointment, empowering their commissioners, quote, to consider how far an uniform system in their commercial regulations and other important matters might be necessary to the common interest and permanent harmony of the several states, end quote, and to report such an act on the subject as when ratified them by them, quote, would enable the United States and Congress assembled effectually to provide for the exigencies of the Union, end quote. Okay, so what they're doing is they're combining all of the authorities of each state. They're stating them.
Yeah, well, so they did that. They said that they're all authorized to do this. And then they go, oh, but here's a unique difference. The Delaware's commissioners were basically, you know, kind of constrained to ensure that the United States and Congress assembled to agreed by them and confirmed by the state legislature. In other words, they weren't given the same powers as you could see in New York. New York was actually looking and offering, you know, enough power that might be necessary to the common interest and permanent harmony of the several states, and then went on, right, you know, and empowered them, would enable the United States and Congress assembled effectually to provide for the exigencies of the Union. So, in other words, right, New York was definitely empowering their delegates, and they only had two, but, you know, they were state, they were, as they voted as states. And so it wasn't a matter of a democracy. You got, you know, four from Virginia, two from, you know, so anyway. So they're laying out the differences between these states. Now, the next, keep going.
All right. The appointments of commissioners have also been made by the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and North Carolina, none of whom, however, have attended, but that no information has been received by your commissioners of any appointment have been made by the states of Connecticut, Maryland, South Carolina, or Georgia. Okay.
So those were the absent states, correct?
Okay. So they're essentially explaining, it's kind of like taking the role and sharing their commissions. So this is how we start out. This is the authority we
have. It's a very formal process. Right. And it's orderly. So, okay.
All right. That the express terms of the powers to your commissioners supposing a deputation from all the states and having for object the trade and commerce of the United States, your commissioners did not conceive it advisable to proceed on the business of their mission under the circumstances of so partial and defective a representation. So they're going to do something, but they don't have a full representation. Right.
Correct.
Deeply impressed, however, with the magnitude and importance of the object confided to them on this occasion, your commissioners cannot forbear to indulge an expression of their earnest and unanimous wish that speedy measures may be taken to effect a general meeting of the states in a future convention for the same and such other purposes as the situation of public affairs may be found to require. So essentially, they don't even have a quorum, but they're going to express the important need for to move forward. Right.
Yeah, and it comes up right here.
If in expressing this wish or in intimating any other sentiment, your commissioners should seem to exceed the strict bounds of their appointment, they entertain a full confidence that a conduct dictated by an anxiety for the welfare of the United States will not fail to receive an indulgent construction. So this kind of addressed what I just said, right? In this persuasion, your commissioners submit an opinion that the idea of extending the powers of their deputies to other objects than those of commerce, which had been adopted by the state of New Jersey, was an improvement on the original plan and will deserve to be incorporated into that of a future convention. They are the more naturally led to this conclusion, as in the course of their reflections on the subject, they have been induced to think that the power of regulating trade is of such comprehensive context and will enter so far into the general system of the federal government that to give it efficacy and to obviate questions and doubts concerning its precise nature and limits may require a correspondent adjustment of other parts of the federal system.
Yep. Okay.
Okay. That there are important defects in the system of the federal government is acknowledged by the act of all those states which have concurred in the present meeting. That the defects upon a closer examination may be found greater and more numerous than even those these acts imply is at least so far probable from the embarrassments which characterize the present state of our national affairs, foreign and domestic, as may reasonably be supposed to merit a deliberate and candid discussion in some mode, which will unite the sentiments and counsels of all the states in the choice of that the mode. Your commissioners are of opinion that a convention of deputies from the different states for the special and sole purpose of entering into this investigation and digesting a plan for supplying such defects as may be discovered to exist will be entitled to a preference from considerations which will occur without being particularized.
Okay,
go ahead.
They're basically saying that they need to have this convention and they need to be able to be unencumbered to deal with all matters, not just commerce, because they kind of addressed that in the previous paragraph. Then, you know, because that's what it said up above. It said, then those of commerce. In other words, the idea of extending the powers of their deputies to other objects than those of commerce, which has been adopted by the state of New Jersey. So they're basically saying, we want to put everything on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, so does it seem like there's this secret effort being done here in trying to, you know, bypass, you know, the guard of the Articles of Confederation and say, you know what, we're out of time, so we're going to have to go straight into a break because I just realized this. So when we come back, I will kind of tie this all together because bottom line, there was nothing nefarious or pernicious or, you know, secretive with what was happening. Everybody saw how the states were actually going. It was chaotic. And there was all sorts of problems because the general government was inadequate. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me back up and let me kind of give everybody some clarity as to why is all these little documents so important. At the beginning of this year, I set out to actually identify the 7 different paths that we have available to us to deal with government going amok. We already talked about the election process. We've talked about the courts. We talked about nullification last year. And right now, as the state legislatures are convening at the very beginning of the year, the discussion seems to be very myopic that we either have to convene a convention or we don't. And those who are the anti-conventionites are out there trying to peddle what we had already proven last year, that nullification, there's 0% chance that nullification can solve a problem. It can't. It is incapable of doing that. Now, to be honest, an amendment does and can fix a problem with the Constitution. The reality is the Constitution is not the problem at all. The problem is that the federal government is not complying. And so, I mean, even the conventionites are actually out there telling you that the only way we can deal with overreaching government, with a government out of control, is through a convention, and they're lying. Mm-hmm. Because the process is very clear right there. You've got the oath of office in Article 6. Then in the First Amendment, we have the right to petition them for the redress of grievances. Not one petition has come out of the Convention of States, folks. Not one. Right. So don't tell me that they understand the Constitution, and do not tell me that their intent is honorable. Because if they actually had an honorable intent, they would be petitioning and petitioning. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like, you know, when Britain started handing out this tyranny with the Stamp Acts and everything else, that they instantly, you know, all of the states jumped in. Hey, we got to create a constitution. Let's go have a constitutional convention. No,
that wasn't
right.
They simply wanted their concerns to be addressed.
Yeah, and this is as we go through all the documents, they were humble and faithful servants. They pointed out, how they were, some of the best servants of all as Englishmen, but they wanted their rights as Englishmen as well. And so, we lay it all out that the first thing they did was not to try to go and create a new government or, make a comment that, hey, we need to do something else. Let's go form a convention to, that was not the first action, nor is it even appropriate at this point in time. And that's the whole point. That's why we're going through these documents. We want to lay waste and basically refute the dialogue of what's going on today. That the fact that your state legislators are wasting their time entertaining lobbyists, not entertaining the actual dialogue. They've got lobbyists pushing them to actually convene a convention. And what they're asking for is a blank check. But we'll dive into all of that as we after we get through this. So as we kind of look, and what we're seeing right here, because the anti-conventionites have told us that, oh, you know, these men, when they went into this convention in Philadelphia, their only thing that they were to do was to actually make certain amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And clearly, what we need to do is we need to actually reread what you just read. And it says, meaning, quote, that the defects upon a closer examination may be found greater and more numerous than even these acts imply. Is it at least so far probable from the embarrassments which characterize the present state of our national affairs, foreign and domestic, as may reasonably be supposed to merit a deliberate and candid conversation in some mode which will unite the sentiments of the councils of the states? In the choice of the mode, your commissioners are of opinion that a convention of deputies from the states for special and sole purpose of entering into this investigation and digesting a plan for supplying such defects as may be discovered to exist will be entitled to a preference from considerations which will occur without being particularized. In other words, not, you know, so that they can go in unencumbered and be able to really solve the problems instead of actually being particularized that you can only do these things. Does that jump out to you to say, wow, they are actually saying that it is essential that this convention actually have the open reins to actually fix all of the exigencies of the union that they can identify and examine?
You know, the promoters of this runaway convention theory, aren't they familiar with these documents?
You would think so.
Okay.
But because, see,
and
so
what you, is, I have to admit to you that,
go ahead.
You know, I'm reading these for the first time, and it's clear to me what the states meant.
Okay, but see, what they have, because I've seen the document, there is this document of these little quotes. In other words, Madison said this, or, you know, all of these different people said these things. And I mean, it's like, you know, maybe let's say they have 100 quotes from different people where they all basically made some assertion that they exceeded their commission.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are hearsays, or those are out of context. And what I mean by that is, you know, somebody could actually in a conversation actually say, you know, it might be viewed, or, you know, I saw that we could have, you know, exceeded our, or some way of saying we've exceeded our commission, but we really didn't. But they don't include that. It's kind of like how they only include a very snippet. They're not citing the whole document so that you can kind of go through, because I'll give you a good case in point, and I'll find it for you later on. Because okay. I know Madison in Federalist Paper 40 comes out and says, you know, it may have been seen that we exceeded our commission.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually clarifies that they didn't. They just don't include that. And so, I mean, if you find it once, then how many other times is it really relative? And then you have to also think, how many of these people were actually just doing everything they could to keep that Constitution from being ratified? Going through the ratification debates, we find well over 100 people making the assertions that these people exceeded their commission. I mean, that was the bread and butter of the anti-federalists. Right. I mean, they were doing everything they could to ensure that the Articles of Confederation did not change, that the state's powers were going to be maintained.
So let me ask you a question. Isn't there an anti-federalist papers?
Yeah. So there were, and you can get the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers in one document. But the problem is they don't necessarily lay them out, because what was happening was there was this dialogue going on in the papers. This is why I the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers are insightful, but they're a waste of time. Because they don't prove anything. They're just editorials. They're just ideas and arguments for, but they have no legal standing.
Right.
The only thing that has legal standing from the Anti-Federalist and the Federalist, if you want to say Anti-Federalist legal standing, because it was on the record. These guys were on, had been sworn in for their testimony at the beginning of these conventions in these different states. And out of the six states that vigorously debated the Constitution, the Anti-Federalists did not hold their punches. I mean, they made all sorts of, crazy assertions to do anything and everything to persuade the states to stay off ratifying it. Just, they say, there may be some good things, but, it's not worthy yet of ratification. We need to make some changes. And that's exactly what they were doing. They were doing everything they could.
This is really a no holds barred argument.
Oh, absolutely. And see, the problem is that they didn't hold the Anti-Federalist to perjury charges, because when you really look at some of the things that were being said, they were just that outlandish. I mean, these men were using hyperbole, and so when you're up there bearing testimony that this document is going to do something, and there's no evidence of that. I mean, George Mason, you made a comment saying that they would have a black witch's cauldron or something like that. They used the word cauldron, that the federal government, because they had this exclusive legislative authority over the district. Now, in the same comment in the ratification debates, he actually says that, their legislation is only effective. This exclusive legislative power is only effective and only pertains to the seat of government. But because they have that power, it will be like a black cauldron of evil spells that they will be able to put and cast upon, that seat of government. And I'm going, that's just hyperbole. Does that make sense? I mean, it's just being outlandish.
Let's stray for just a second.
Sure.
Okay, we'll get back to this. But I just had a conversation with someone yesterday about the acts of Congress applying only to the District of Columbia.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the case, is it? If in other words, Congress can do what it wants with the District of Columbia. Correct. However, within the states and through our representation, a constitutional law passed applies to the states because our representation has agreed to it. Correct.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead and repeat that, please. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So I'm having this conversation and the person I'm talking to says, legislation of Congress only applies to the District of Columbia.
Okay.
I said, no. It does, because they have exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia. However, that doesn't exclude constitutional provisions applying to the states because our representatives assent to them. Correct?
So... federal acts.
In other words.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead and finish your, in other words.
No. In other words, the acts of Congress apply to the states. Okay. And this person is trying to agree that they don't.
Okay. So I mean, when you say the acts of Congress, the Alien and Sedition Acts, the Alien and Sedition Acts were actually written. And they, excuse me, they were written and they were intended for the states, right? I mean, in 1798, Congress was not writing Alien Sedition Acts for its application only to the District of Columbia. Those acts were intended for all the states. Now, based on the Constitution, there's nothing that keeps Congress from actually making an act for the District of Columbia based on the exclusive legislative authority for that seat of government, which is Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17. So when we go and say now they want to apply these acts for the states, then before they actually, you know, well, so if the states go along with them, then they're just going along with tyranny. But the only way that they're legitimately applied to the states is if these laws or these acts are in pursuance to the Constitution. They have to be directly derived from enumerated powers.
Okay, that is the point I wanted you to make.
Okay. So when we look at, and if you want to give me an act, a recent act, you know, I can grab one like the ADA or the Civil Rights Acts. Both of those acts were intended to be applied to the states, but none of those acts were derived from enumerated powers.
So, question again, I'm straying for just a little bit.
Yep, no problem.
So, those acts, by nature of Congress's exclusive authority, do apply in the District of Columbia. However,
yes,
they're not in pursuance of the Constitution. The states, you know, and I would say conditioning out of ignorance, accept them. But if they don't, then what they need to do is pursue republic review. Right?
Yes. In other words, they have to basically do what Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. So actually, you know, had the states been vigilant and had they actually done what they should have been doing, they would have actually come up by now, at least, especially in today's technology. We would have actually had a process in place that would actually inject itself before a bill was actually sent over to the president for signature. In other words, it'd basically be a shot to say, Congress, you just passed a bill that you had no authority to do. And President, if you sign this bill, then we would see this as a violation of your oath. And we're already very upset with the fact that Congress has violated their oath because they've created a law or an act that's intended for the states that they have no authority to do.
Mm.
So, I mean, if we're working smarter and not harder, we could actually, you know, really help Congress stay within, you know, those ropes around the fighting ring, right? I mean, you got the ring in the center of the auditorium. There's ropes that keep the fighters in there. But right now, it's just like the fighters are not, they're not only throughout the auditorium, they're outside the building.
Okay. All right, GR. Well, I've taken that stray thought, I think, probably as far as I can right now.
Okay, that's fine.
So let me go to the next one.
Sure.
Okay. Your commissioners decline an enumeration of those national circumstances on which their opinion respecting the propriety of a future convention with more enlarged powers is founded, as it would be an useless intrusion of facts and observations, most of which have been frequently the subject of public discussion, and none of which can have escaped the penetration of those to whom they would in this instance be addressed. They are, however, of a nature so serious as in the view of your commissioners to render the situation of the United States delicate and critical, calling for an exertion of the united virtue and wisdom of all members of the Confederacy. That's interesting.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay.
So, again, another mouthful.
Uh-huh.
For a 21st century reader.
I will, unless if you have, I don't even know where to start with questions. So if you've got a few things of clarification, I'm open to them. Otherwise,
yeah. So what they're basically saying right there in that very first line, your commissioners, in other words, those of us here that are representing you that sent us here, decline. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're not going to create an enumeration of those national circumstances on which their opinion respecting the propriety of a future. In other words, they're not going to create a list because it's just too numerous.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Mm-hmm. So next paragraph. Under this impression, your commissioners, with the most respectful deference, beg leave to suggest their unanimous conviction that it may essentially tend to advance the interests of the Union if the states by whom they have been respectively delegated would themselves concur and use their endeavors to procure the concurrence of the other states in the appointment of commissioners to meet at Philadelphia on the second Monday in May next, to take into consideration the situation of the United States, to devise such further provisions as shall appear to them necessary to render the Constitution of the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the Union, and to report such an act for that purpose to the United States and Congress assembled, as when agreed to by them, and afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state, will effectually provide for the same.
Right.
Though your commissioners could not with propriety address these observations and sentiments to any but the states they have the honor to represent, they have nevertheless concluded from motives of respect to transmit copies of this report to the United States in Congress assembled and to the executives of the other states by order of the commissioners dated at Annapolis, September 14, 1786. Resolved that the chairman signed the foregoing report in behalf of the commissioners. Oh, my goodness. They actually only met for a few days.
Yeah.
And decided that the circumstances, one, they didn't have a quorum. Two, the circumstances are so urgent that there needs to be a convention.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay. Let me go back to this one paragraph. Under this impression, Your commissioners, basically, this is something that they're both going to commute back to their states as well as Congress. Under this impression, your commissioners, with the most respectful deference, beg leave to suggest their unanimous conviction that it may essentially tend to advance the interest of the Union. And this is what I have underlined in bold in my document. If the states by whom they have been respectively delegated would themselves concur and use their endeavors, these commissioners' endeavors, to procure the concurrence of the other states in the appointment of commissioners to meet in Philadelphia on the second Monday in May next, to take into consideration the situation of the United States, to devise such further provisions as shall appear to them necessary, not to, you know, what the state's legislatures said that we only want you to do this, what appear empowering them to do what's necessary to render the Constitution of the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the Union. There you go. In other words, you know, we really need to get serious about addressing how we're going to govern ourselves, because this is not working for us. This top-down model is just, it's failed because they have no energy. So how do we create this top-down model, but create it so it's so limited that we actually have all the residual mass and power at the bottom level?
Right.
And that's where I think the divine hand of providence, our creator, basically, he was prepared because he's always risen to the occasion, has he not? And voila, he gave us a government that actually did just that. It confined our, you know, this all-powerful central government, very limited. It defined it and limited it to very specific powers. And that's it.
Right.
and everything else is left to the states and the counties to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you kind of went through this, this basically was signed again by the chairman and it was sent out. And again, this was a very powerful shot across the bow where, you know, these states were getting very anxious and very tired of the chaos and the lack of, you know, the lack of the union. I mean, what does the word union imply? Unity, right? There was no unity in the union. It was just a word. It was lipstick on a pig.
Okay. And they understood that there were dangers inherent, you know, looking down the future, there were dangers inherent in maintaining the union as it was because, you know, the other nations were watching America and it wasn't looking good. All right. In fact, I believe that they were rebuffed by England because they didn't have a, how should I put this, a national government that had any, everyone recognized outside the United States that the states were just, that there was chaos in America, right?
Yep. And so, I mean, the foreign nations that we were dealing with were kind of laughing because they would pursue a better trade deal from the next state that came along, and because they were ignoring the Articles of Confederation that only trade deals could be done by the Continental Congress, but the states were doing it themselves.
Right. So even the states were ignoring the articles.
Yeah, but there were enough people in each of the states to recognize, and I think that when you look at how they chose the delegates to go and represent the states, there may have been a few of the men of character to say, hey, you know, this. There may have been this underlying tone that, hey, you need to protect our cabal. And I think that when you look at Livingston from New York, I think that that was his attitude because he was reporting on Hamilton's shenanigans. And if you look at the ratification debates, he wasn't a staunch proponent. I mean, Hamilton was really kind of floundering by himself, which is probably another reason why he dove into political theory, you know, just to waste time until Virginia could ratify and they would get the news that Virginia had ratified. Now what are we going to do? So when you look at some of the players, if you understand that Livingston, by just reading what he said in the ratification debates, I think you can, you know, you can conclude, and we're out of time now, but I think anybody can conclude that it becomes heir apparent that there were people that were in the convention that initially had the premonition to guard the cabals. Folks, this is all important so that we can really lay waste to what direction we take so that we can work efficaciously and efficiently. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
...you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.